Sean Carroll is an acclaimed theoretical physicist from Caltech. He's the author of the highly praised books From Eternity to Here and The Particle at the End of the Universe. He is a rock star in and out of the science community. In fact, he was personally offered jobs by Stephen Hawking twice and turned them both down. In the vein of Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, Sean Carroll's new book, The Big Picture, on the origins of life, meaning, and the universe itself. He takes readers on a journey of unprecedented scientific scope, examining everything from the matter that makes up the far reaches of our universe to the molecules that make up our DNA, and all the biology, physics, astronomy, and humanity in between. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology who has worked on the foundations of quantum mechanics, the arrow of time, and the emergence of complexity. We welcome Sean Carroll to the roundtable this morning. Sean Carroll, are you on the line?
I am here.
Excellent. I was just saying that it seems to me somewhat amusing that while you, as a theoretical physicist, are working on these issues of life and meaning and the universe itself, we are trying to figure out how to turn on a phone.
That's why I'm a theoretical physicist. I would not be able to help you with these complicated technological issues.
Okay. Well, I thank you for making us feel a little bit better. I was reading the book, and first of all, let me say, I understood more of the book than I thought I would. I figured I would be...
That's what I like to hear.
Yeah, I just figured I'd be knocked out of the park and wouldn't understand a damn thing. But I do understand it. You have a wonderful way of explaining these things. At what point did you decide that you wanted to present, really, as you say in the book title, this big picture?
You know, this is the kind of thing I've been working toward for a long time now. I've always been personally interested in not just physics, but all the big questions of, you know, philosophy and biology and so forth. And I'm not an expert in many of these issues. I'm very quick to admit that. But then there is no human being who's an expert in all of these areas. I'm a big believer that we should be talking to each other, that we should carry on the dialogue and try to do the work of sort of seeing how all of what we've learned about the universe fits together to make the world we live in.
So when you set out to write the book, what did you want us, what is the story that you ultimately wanted to tell?
Well, the story that I'm pitching in the book is what I call poetic naturalism. So it's the idea that there's only one world, only one universe, the natural world, but there's many different ways of talking about it. When we do biology, when we do philosophy, we're still talking about the same world that physics is talking about, just using a different language. And this is a picture we've pieced together over just the last few hundred years. And it's both an exciting picture, but also challenging. Like, one of the points I make in the book is, what we've learned about the world teaches us that life ends when we die. There's no life after death. So that puts a lot of pressure on us in the short lives we have here on Earth to sort of make something of it and to do something good.
When you think about what we know, and as you said, over the past few hundred years of coming up with this idea of what we're talking about, and yet there are still questions, right? There are still great question marks out there that we still need to explore to fully understand the big picture. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are a huge number of questions, and I want to sort of make that very clear, because I talk about a lot of things in the book, but there's a lot of answers I don't give because we don't know them. I don't say what happened at the origin of the universe or at the origin of life. I don't explain what consciousness really is or how to be a good person. I talk about the framework within which we can think about these questions. That's what we sort of established. But all the hard work is left to be done in really getting down to the nitty-gritty of these details.
So you make the case against the existence of God. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so how do you make that case?
Well, I sort of say that, you know, God is an idea that was a very natural idea to have. We, you know, we look at the world, there's a whole bunch of things that we can't understand, we can't explain, but we try harder and harder. We sort of, over the course of years, over the course of centuries, we ask more and more detailed questions about the world, and we discover things. We discover things like, it goes all the way back to conservation of momentum, that if you were Aristotle, you would have thought that the natural way that objects move is that they sit still, and you have to push them to get them moving. But now we know that the natural motion of things is to keep moving and doing whatever they're doing until some force acts on them. So Aristotle argued that you needed God to keep the universe moving, but now we know that that's not true. And that kind of thing happens over and over again to the point where God isn't really serving any useful purpose in accounting for the world that we see. So that leaves us alone in the world, which is both scary a little bit, but also a little bit exciting, that we get to come up with our own answers for the purposes of meaning and mattering in the world.
So where does that put those of us who believe in a God?
Well, I certainly hope in the book to have a dialogue. You know, I'm very respectful of religious traditions. I think that in terms of being a person, you know, how to live our lives, over the last several thousand years, the hardest thought about those deep questions has been carried out within religious traditions. I think the ontology, what philosophers refer to ontology as, is just the fundamental stuff out of which nature is made. I think now we have a better idea about ontology than we did 2,000 years ago. So we need to update what we think about the world. But that still leaves open all these hard questions about how to be a good person, which I think that religious people can contribute to just as much as naturalists can.
You spoke a moment ago at the beginning of our conversation about how life after death is unlikely and that we have to make the best of our time here because we don't really, in the grand scheme of things, have all that long. So why you believe life after death is unlikely? Why do you believe that's a positive thing for us?
Well, I wouldn't even say it's a positive thing. I mean, it's just a true thing, right? You know, I think that we get in trouble when we start to decide whether or not certain aspects of reality are good or bad because that biases us a little bit. I actually don't think that the fact that life ends when we die is an especially good thing. I would be very happy to have it continue on in some even better form. I think the evidence points otherwise. And what that means is that the life that we do have here, what I refer to in the book as the 3 billion heartbeats that each human being has, roughly speaking, in their life expectancy, is enormously precious. You know, that's what matters in the world is the things that we have right around us right now, because in some sense that's all there is. So it gives us, I think, a greater appreciation for making the world we live in right now as good a place as we can.
So you talked about biases, and you write in the book about how these biases keep us from changing our beliefs, even in the face of evidence that in many ways is inconsistent.
Yes, it's amazing. The more we study psychology and neuroscience and so forth, the more we learn how irrational human beings can be. And, you know, we're not brought up by evolution necessarily to think like perfectly reasonable Vulcans like Mr. Spock on Star Trek. So what we can do is recognize what our biases are, try to account for them, you know, try to sort of take them into consideration when we're making decisions. If there's something we really, really, really want to be true, that's what we should be especially skeptical about, especially dubious until the evidence is really absolutely solid in favor of it.
You do make the claim in the book, and I know this raises eyebrows, but you make the claim in the book that ultimately science never proves anything, going to somewhat the point you were just making. Why is that the case, that science never proves anything?
Well, you know, even though we think about science as something that is part and parcel of mathematics and logic, it's ultimately a very different endeavor. You know, in math, you do prove things. You start with axioms like Euclid did, and you prove theorems about geometry. And what you're proving is that if those axioms are correct, then your theorem is correct. Whereas in science, we don't get to assume the axioms. We're actually looking at the actual world. Mathematical or logical truth would be true in any possible world. But when you talk about, you know, is the universe expanding or contracting, we can imagine it either way. We could imagine universes that are getting bigger or getting smaller. We have to go look at the universe to figure out which one we're in. And when we do look at it, when we gather data, that increases our confidence, our credence in one answer versus another. But it goes from, you know, 80% to 90% to 99.9%. It never reaches 100%. We always need to be open to changing our minds when new information, new data comes down the line.
You talk in the book, and you have a chapter near the end of the book, about ultimately listening to what the world has to say. How do we do that, and what do we benefit from that?
Well, again, it's an issue with dealing with our own cognitive biases. You know, we have a way that we've grown up through evolution for dealing with the world around us, the immediate world. We're based on, you know, heuristics. We feel certain things are going to be certain ways. That's why we see optical illusions, for example, because when you see things in the world, it's not just a photograph that your eyes take. Your brain fills in what it thinks should be there. And when I say listening to the world, I mean like being a little bit more attentive to how the world really is, and not necessarily saying that what is natural or what is true is therefore good, but at least, you know, we can take that into consideration when we sit down for ourselves and try to decide what we think is good, what is meaningful and good in our lives.
Ultimately, what do you hope people get from the book? There are a lot of big ideas in the big picture. So the thought process being what when we are done of what we start to think about?
Well, I hope it gets people thinking. That's really the biggest single goal that there is. It is a long book with a lot of stuff in there, but I tried very hard to break it up into short, bite-sized chapters. You could, you know, read a few pages and think about that. And want to get that conversation going. Want people to think that science and philosophy and our deepest understandings of the world are not some esoteric thing apart from what they care about in their everyday lives. It's our universe. You know, we live in it, and our best understanding of the world is something that should be shared in a common human heritage. So everyone should know a little bit about the basics of physics and cosmology and biology and philosophy and so forth, and so they can talk about it and share with their friends and try to come to a really well-informed idea of what they how they want to live in the world, what they want to make of their own personal 3 billion heartbeats.
The name of the book is The Big Picture: On the Origins of Life, Meaning, and the Universe Itself. The book is published by Dutton. Sean Carroll, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program and for you to share your expertise.
Thanks very much for having me.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology. The name of the new book is The Big Picture. It is published by Dutton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.